Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha! Yup, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dad!
Monkey tennis?
Little piece, my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay. Monkey tennis?
Edmunds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. We're now halfway through the current series, On the Road to Stratagem, Alan's first live outing for some time. And on our way there, we're going to be looking at all of Steve's previous live work as Alan Partridge. So I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Think.
Nick Alder.
Act.
And Tom Stab.
That's it.
It really is it. Speaking of things that are it, we're going to be starting with Steve's 1998 show, The Man Who Thinks He's It. But are we the men who think it's shit? Let's find out. You may well have strong opinions on Steve's live work as well. You might have revisited this in the run-up to our podcast. We'd love to hear your thoughts, of course. So Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, Facebook.com/The Partridge Pod, ThePartridgePod@gmail.com, or you can leave us a voice note on the Monkey Tennis hotline, 07923 600 017. So as with previous episodes, I think it makes sense to throw to Mr. Tom Dark for a little bit of scene setting.
Yeah, I've kind of become unofficially almost the archivist role in this series. But yeah, I think it is worth putting this in the context of Coogan's output and also the Partridge universe. So in 1992, Coogan won the Perrier Award doing an in-character stand-up show with John Thompson. That award-winning show featured characters Paul Calf, Duncan Thicket, Ernest Moss and Alan Partridge. Interestingly, his first stand-up show that was released on VHS and DVD was a show from 1994 called Live and Lewd, which didn't feature Alan Partridge. So this is the first commercially available show that features Alan. I don't think there's any kind of filmed evidence for the 1992 award-winning show online. I don't know if anybody has watched Live and Lewd, but I would say it's quite similar in approach and tone to The Man Who Thinks He's It, in terms of you do get some kind of Steve Coogan, kind of like the character Steve Coogan, kind of behind the scenes background type stuff. You know, he arrives in a Porsche saying, park that and watch the paintwork, losing his shit about brown bread not being granary bread as per his rider requests. And then, yeah, you've got John Thompson is the character Bernard Wrighton, who's a compare a bit like Bernard Manning, but with right on views. And then you've got Pauline Calf, Duncan Thicket, Ernest Moss, and then Paul Calf is the last character in that show. And then just to bring us up to the context of this 1998 show, Coogan played 200 performances of this show. So 200 performance tour. It was seen by 350,000 people, according to Chortle. That is a ruddy bloody lot of people. In London, he did this at the Lyceum Theatre from September to December 1998. And I can also give you a bit of context from Coogan's autobiography, Easily Distracted, that I have here. In the opening chapter of this book, he talks about this tour. So a few excerpts from this, because it's essentially, I think at this point, arguably, Coogan was probably at a bit of a career peak in terms of commercial success, Partridge being huge, and him being a massive, massive stand-up comedian proposition. So it's kind of like a drink and drugs heck thing going on here. So it opens with, if 1998 was the year that everything came together, it was also the year that everything began slowly to fall apart. He then talks about he had his parents in a hotel room overlooking the Lyceum Theatre with his name in lights. He writes, I was about to turn 33, I had the best comedy on television, a sellout national tour, and I'm Alan Partridge was incredibly popular and liked by clever people. Alan had matured to perfection. The reviews were staggering. It was probably peak Partridge. I had yet to be overwhelmed by drugs and drink, but I can see now that the adulation sent me a bit crazy. I earned well over £1 million from a man who thinks he's it, the kind of money I didn't earn again for a very long time.
That's interesting.
So that is the scene being set. I mean, this whole chapter about this tour in Easily Distracted is well worth a read, but it's quite long, so I think we'll probably leave it there.
Is there anything else in that chapter that it's worth highlighting? Have you got sort of highlights? Obviously not reading out loads of chunks, but like, what is the general sort of, did it go well in terms of, like, obviously it went well in terms of ticket sales, but like, did it do a lot for him in terms of raising his profile? Did he go on to bigger and better things after that? Because there's quite a gap, obviously, this and 2002, when you get I'm Alan Partridge Series 2.
Yeah, I mean, without going into huge long chunks, yeah, I mean, you know, the fact it was a 10-week run at the Lyceum Theatre, he does write, as I was on my way to stage during my anorak, ticket touts would try to sell me tickets for my own show at £300 a pop. Six nights a week, I was dressed as these characters in front of 2,000 people. I was determined to create an intimate show on a large scale with musicians, dancers and a supporting cast. But yeah, at this point, so he does write, in the midst of the sellout show, I was rewarded three times at the British Comedy Awards, Best Actor and Best Sitcom for I'm Alan Partridge and Best BBC Two Personality. That's quite a niche award. And also the I'm Alan Partridge won a BAFTA for Best Comedy and he won one for Best Comedy Performance. So that was all happening at the same time. So hugely commercially successful tour, critical adulation, and winning awards. Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear the context that this was like a 200-date tour with 10 weeks at the Lyceum, because I don't know if anyone else noticed this, but watching it, I found it hard to square the sort of huge popularity that I knew he had at the time with the fact that this seemed like a relatively small venue. Mm. And I think actually it speaks more to how comedy was promoted in the UK back in 1998, in that it was probably seen more akin to theatre. And it seems like the kind of setup he had is almost a setup you'd have for like when Book of Mormon goes on tour or something. You know, you go and do 3 weeks in Manchester followed by 3 weeks in Cardiff, that sort of thing. Whereas now I think this is almost before the advent of arena comedy, because I imagine comedians at that point, you know, perhaps rightly, didn't think that comedy translated to, you know, the O2s of this world. But obviously things have changed massively now. Stratagem will be an arena show. And I think that's only partly down to, you know, perhaps having less stamina as you get older. I think it's more about, you know, the commercials of it all, and you know, people, it'd be more accepted that you can now put a comedy show in a giant enormous dome.
Well, I think there's a couple of points there, because I think by this point I think you would have had like Newman and Badil at Wembley or whatever it was. You know, there was quite an infamous point where that was like the first time in kind of the early 90s where comedy did kind of go arena size. But I think specifically with this show, it seems to me like Coogan really wanted it to feel like a theatrical experience, you know, writing about having kind of like musical direction and stuff like that. So I think in his mind, this is very much supposed to feel like a theatrical experience. So that feels like the appropriate medium for having those sort of size venues. So, yeah, he could have done like 10 arenas or 200 theatres. And I think that was probably a deliberate choice on his part as well, to make it feel a bit more intimate, perhaps.
I do wonder if Stratagem will have sort of music involved in it, because obviously the man who thinks he's it, and obviously we'll come on to less successful characters, are kind of, there is a kinship there between those two productions in how they're, you know, how they're set and the way they're laid out, and that there's music as well. So I do wonder if Stratagem will as well.
It does feel like all bets are off a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's a much bigger gap between live shows this time around. I mean, and also, I'm sure it's a point we'll come back to, but if you look at The Man Who Thinks He's It, less successful characters and Stratagem, the proportion of Partridge obviously grows with every show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we're at a point now where arguably, but potentially, you know, the kind of the Tommy Thickets, maybe even the Paul Carfs of this world, don't have a place in a live show because it's been so long since their kind of character heyday.
Yeah, I would agree that's right. And I'm sure that's kind of quite a big kind of thing to draw upon as we go through these couple of live shows. And yeah, it kind of feels like that natural progression is an absolute no-brainer, that it's gone from, well, the fact that there was no Partridge in 94, it's half an hour of Partridge in 98, it's 45 minutes of Partridge in 2009, it's full Partridge in 2022. It just actually makes a lot of sense. And I think particularly when we delve into the content of what Alan is delivering, I think the format actually really hopefully will lend itself to what we kind of think Stratagem is going to be.
Does the fact that this show was out in 1998, sort of broadly pre-ish internet, mean that we don't have much to go on in terms of critic reviews of the time? They're not archived? That sort of thing's not available online?
Ooh, that's a good... I mean, I haven't come across any.
Certainly all the reviews that I found looking for Partridge Live relate to, you know, the show that we'll cover in a future episode rather than this one.
So should we just kind of rattle through all the pre-Partridge characters? Any highlights to delve into? I mean, for me personally, I do love the Coogan, the character in this show. I think that's a particularly strong point.
Yeah, I wonder is it worth kind of... that feels like a sort of strand that we could sort of pull out a little bit. And I think kind of not to spoil too much my view of this, but I enjoyed the Steve moments almost more than the most of his kind of characters. I mean, we've kind of seen the sort of merging of Steve and Alan, but I don't know how you felt, but there's so much of Alan in Steve throughout these kind of little montages. And maybe we should kind of make it clear for people that haven't seen it, what you essentially get is these kind of sort of micro sketches of Steve kind of playing a version of the character of Steve Coogan.
It's like a hyped up version of himself, like a ultra kind of lovey, actory version of himself, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's played as kind of a behind the scenes skit where you're seeing Steve playing this kind of ultra over the top version of himself. And it's, I guess the overall theme is the people who are working with him in this production don't particularly like him, and Steve's ego is kind of out of control, is probably the headline view of how most of these kind of skits play out.
Yeah, and I think there's a through line here. Like I say, this kind of exists in Live and Lewd. It's very strongly a part of this, and, you know, we'll get into this next week with the 2009 show, but again, playing on this character that basically has the ego of a maniac, drink and drugs heck, and basically nobody likes him. I do like the fact he evolves that idea even further in the other live show that we'll discuss. But I mean, I love the fact, you know, that it opens with the camera shot on his BAFTAs and things like that. And it's like, once he introduces himself in the third person, you then get an Aston, like the actual text come up with his name, like he wouldn't know who that is. And also, did you clock first quite big visual gag when he had the animation exploding saying the man who thinks he's it? Did you guys spot the gag there?
Don't think so.
No.
Ah, good. Okay. So, like, as the letters kind of tumble away from the explosion, for a split second, it spells out shite. It's a really, really good little subtle gag there. And you've got Peter Bainham doing the voiceover section here, haven't you?
Yeah, I did think that was Bainham. But I do like the way that this is set up with him sort of arriving at the theatre. It's very good.
Yeah. Have you got any of the quotes from this voiceover? I think these are just worth flagging. Has anybody got them?
From Peter Bainham?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I've not got those.
Go for it.
Oh, so it's the biggest show for 600 years. his voice is insured for 99 billion quid. And they refer to, like, basically Steve, like, doing vocal warm-ups as Steve has one final dick about. I thought that was a lot of fun.
And yeah, there's Julia Davis, obviously, and some other guy. I don't really know who.
He didn't really go on to anything.
No,
after
he never
this,
really
did he?
Went on to
the
do anything.
The guy
else,
with this kind of spiky blonde hair. I like him. He's a bit punky.
He's a bit punky. Yeah. We're only joking. It's Simon Pegg, of course. So this would be pre-Spaced, right? And because Spaced was 99, I think, and he'd done obviously his cameo in or small part, because it's not really a cameo because no one knew who he was, in the first series of I'm Alan Partridge in 97. But he hadn't really done much else. So obviously this must have been when he was probably in the midst of writing Spaced.
I mean, I guess, what years was Big Train? So Big Train was 98 to 2002. So yeah, this is kind of very early days for him. In fact, if Wikipedia is fully accurate, his kind of fourth TV appearance was in I'm Alan Partridge. So yeah, very early days for him.
I don't know what you kind of thought. It was one of the sort of weaker moments of the kind of Steve character comedy, was the kind of the kiss moment with Simon Pegg. I thought that was a bit of a strange kind of scene. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts, you know, looking back on that. Does that work? Is that funny? I thought it was one of the weaker parts of that kind of Coogan character.
I like it personally, because I think what they're trying to demonstrate with the character there is, like, it's almost like he'll try and fuck anything that moves. So he doesn't care. You know, the fact his advances have been rejected by one of the female cast, he's then trying to hit on one of the male cast.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we start to talk about the other characters in the show and maybe touch on some of the highlights? So I think first up, we've got Pauline Calf.
Yep. I mean, it's a Coogan mainstay. This is the first character we see on stage. We find out Fat Bob is sadly departed. RIP Fat Bob. I mean, what did you guys think of this bit? Like, I think it's broadly funny, but I just don't know if it's aged that well. And I also feel like with Pauline Calf, the setup is kind of always the same. Like, this book reading element of it, I think, happens in every Pauline Calf live show that he's done.
The main thing that I took away from it was that it's a sort of very bygone era of comedy, isn't it? That's kind of what you're saying about it not aging particularly well. It feels like, I know Steve.
It was a different time.
It was a different
time,
is what I'm saying. But no, but not just in terms of the content, but just in terms of the type of stand-up comedy that it is. It just feels a bit like, I don't know, Working Men's Club kind of very, mm-hmm. very basic comedy. And I think comedy in general, certainly, obviously, alternative comedy, whatever you want to call it, the format of what is and isn't comedy these days has kind of evolved so much that the lines between, you know, drama and comedy, there's so many things that are sort of black comedy. This is almost like, yeah, just a kind of, it feels like it should be in a room full of people smoking, drinking pints, and it's just it comedy has moved on effectively. So it's what at the time probably may have seemed a bit cutting edge, in that it's Alan playing this character Pauline Calf, just doesn't feel relevant or
Alan.
Doesn't feel quite as relevant in 2022 as maybe it would have done in the 90s.
Yeah, I think if you substituted this out with another personality that we didn't necessarily rate in the same way that you rate Steve Coogan, I think there's no way that we'd kind of defend this in the way that we might be doing now. I mean, I think it's very kind of cabaret in every sense of the word, and it's got a bit of a cruise ship feel, isn't it? It's kind of got us entertainment on a kind of cruise ship. And I just think, as you said, Tom, it is comedy just of a bit of a bygone era, and comedy has moved on. I'm pretty sure if I saw this in 98, I would have found this very funny. But watching it now, I think it's just tastes have moved on, and comedy itself has moved on. And therefore, it's hard to find this funny in 2022, I think.
I really don't profess to be any sort of expert on the evolution of drag either, but it does feel like this is very much of a time where, you know, you've still got kind of Lily Savage, Dame Edna Everage on TV, and there's an element, I think, in some aspects of drag around this time, perhaps not with those characters, but certainly with Pauline Calf, that it's the notion of a man dressed as a woman is supposed to in and of itself be funny, whereas now I feel like drag is much more of a kind of celebratory thing, less of a kind of, you know, it's funny to look at thing. Well, certainly not, you know, not that it's funny to look at anymore. So I think that's another good example of how this is kind of its time and perhaps even at the tail end of an era, rather than, you know, in the middle or right at the beginning of one.
I mean, I think, you know, I did like some of the punchlines in this set, but I mean, you know, they could kind of work with any character because it's all about the subversion of the punchline. So things like, I thought I saw him walking past McDonald's, but he'd never have done that, or don't leave me with your daughter. You know, like the way those are delivered, it's, you know, it's pretty like kind of route one stand-up comedy. So yeah, the character itself doesn't really actually enhance it, I don't think, but yeah, in 1998, but perhaps so. I mean, for me, probably my favourite bit is when she's reading the romance novel and the kind of the end line is, get out of here, you shower of shite, fuck off, she said. You know, I just, when he turns the crude up to 11 in that character, I think he inhabits it so well, I can't help but laugh at it. But yeah, it's kind of, it was a different time, yeah.
So is it next up, is it Duncan Thicket?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's worth it. The Coogan bit we get before Duncan Thicket is he's had a 3 out of 5 review in The Guardian, which does then get pulled through the show. So he's read this. Well, in fact, I think the behind-the-scenes bit starts from shouting at a makeup artist, don't fuck me about. So again, you're seeing Coogan being an arsehole to the crew. But yeah, he's read this Guardian review and he says, I feel a bit sorry for him. I won't let it bother me, but he is a fucking fucker, and then spits on the paper. So again, I just like they're really building up this character of Coogan the arsehole. But yeah, I think it's time for Duncan Thicket.
I like Duncan Thicket. I think it's funny.
Thank you. Same here.
So what I would say is that obviously the character, the top line of the character is that he's meant to be a rubbish stand-up comedian. I think he's
can't help but laugh every time.
I don't even think he's that bad a stand-up comedian. I think the jokes that, or the way that it's sort of told, I think it's quite good. I quite like it. I like Duncan Thicket. I wish there was more.
I have a theory on this. Much like we know that when it comes to extras and Nick would genuinely watch and enjoy When the Whistle Blows, I think this is exactly Nick's level. Face value, yes please.
I sort of feel like it should work, but I found this a bit of a struggle. But you're right, it would actually normally be in my wheelhouse. But yeah, I mean, this and David Daft, I didn't think it was that funny. The only bit I thought was quite good, although I did see the joke coming a mile off, was where he did the self-deprecating humour and he just like, like that line was good.
That is amazing.
That is a good
that,
line.
That is. I mean, look, I think for this as well, and it's like, yes, the jokes are obvious, but I think the conceit of this character and the delivery, because I mean, look, I think no matter what we think of a lot of these characters we go along, I don't think you can't really fault Coogan for his like comic delivery and timing, I think.
No, definitely
and
not.
Particularly with Duncan Thicket, I feel like he's really having his cake and eating it because he's basically doing all these Route 1 basic gags, but in the guise of a character. So he's allowing himself to do what would be really basic comedy that is in theory kind of beneath him. And, you know, the fact you've got this section about observational comedy, have you ever noticed? And, you know, all those jokes are like so shit, but in the concept of the character it works. And also, so he gets to kind of take the piss out of the successful tropes of observational comedy at the time, and then also character comedy at the time, and self-depreciating comedy. Like, you know, I think it's kind of like we talked about the writing on this time a bit in the past, like the having the cake and eating it thing, where the surface level thing that you're doing actually just adds a layer of like the joke that you're managing to get away with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that there's also an element of it that it's quite a neat way for, I've seen other comedians do this too, it's quite a neat way to kind of say to perhaps critics, you know, I could do this if I wanted to. Here's how well I could do it if I could be bothered. But in fact, I'm going to basically prove that I could nail this kind of mainstream comedy, but do it, you know, in a smarter way and do it in a throwaway way as part of a much bigger show. So it's kind
is
of...
This, yeah. Is this basically the equivalent of Deftones releasing Back to School? Because they were like, oh, the record label asked them to write a massive commercial banger. And they were like, yeah, fine, we can just do that, whatever we want. But it's just, what I would say about Duncan Thicket is, even though I said earlier I would like to see more, I think if you spent half an hour in the company of this character, it would get way too much. But for
I don't need more. I think this is just enough.
Yeah, for 5 minutes, I think it's very, very enjoyable.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, because this is a thing, like, and I'm sure we'll get to this, like, you know, I've watched this so many times over the years. This was kind of, I remember getting into this at the same time as kind of all the Partridge kind of VHS, DVDs, whatever. And a lot of this section, I still can't help but laugh, even though the punchlines are so obvious and so basic. And, you know, and also just lines like, look at me, I've got matching shoes. And if you think that's funny, thanks. Just, again, the way he delivers those, it just cracks me up every time. So there, for me, there's a certain charm to it. And maybe a lot of that is also bound up with nostalgia and familiarity. Like, I think that's also a given. But I do love this section. Although I would say the Celtic legend bit, the wise man of Stevenage at the end, that is a bit rubbish. It feels a bit like the whole segment kind of really fizzles out. Like, for me, I thought it was quite strong up till there. You know, lines like, I got stung by a wasp. I once got stung by a wasp for 50 quid. I'm
don't
a right
run away,
company.
Don't run away.
It's a funny old world, isn't it? Except from war and diseases.
I like that bit.
Yeah, and you know the thing about when he's like making out with a man who's 50 in the cinema? Laugh or cry, the choice is yours. I just love the way he kind of finishes off a lot of those lines. So for me, this is like classic Coogan, but the end bit just doesn't work, I don't think.
We have another short interlude after Duncan Thicket before we go into Tony Farino. And there's just a line in this that made me laugh. So he describes the show as Bruce Forsyth meets the internet, which is a line that's so preposterous and ludicrous that it just stood out as one of the highlights of those cutscenes.
And he's also still obsessed with the Guardian review at this point. This is when he says I'd shove 3 stars up his arse, besides I don't let it bother me. And then he's made a toilet chain stuck into a ball of plasticine with fish hooks on it in case he meets the reviewer.
So he's taking it fine.
Yeah, he's taking it fine.
He's chilled. He's chilled out.
So next we have Tony Farino. I would say personally, this for me was definitely one of the weaker characters.
I think it's the weakest character. Yeah. By far the weakest character. I don't really have anything to say. Didn't really find any of it funny. Like, this, the whole shtick of Tony Farino, never liked it. Never found it that funny. I don't understand why it's in there.
Tony Farino, I feel, I mean, I might not be quite right on the timelines here, but I feel like it was one of the first characters cooked up post Partridge, or it was the Coogan's next character after Partridge. And I feel like,
I think you're right, yeah, in terms of like having BBC specials and stuff.
I think for that reason it benefited from a lot of Partridge goodwill and good crossover, and I think perhaps it was allowed to continue longer than it should have. But I do find that there are some funny moments in Tony Farino, but I just think him as a character doesn't have a lot of staying power. I think it's kind of, you know, the odd musical number, fine. Lest we forget, didn't he also duet with Bjork on Comic Relief 1 year, Tony Farino?
Should we go to the fact cave for that quickly? Yes, you are correct. Wow, that passed me by.
I knew I didn't dream it.
I mean, I was going to say about this bit, I have to give it to Steve Brown, aka Glenn Ponder. Lap Dancing Lady is a bit of an earworm. Like, that did get stuck in my head over the past week after watching
this. I do also think the musical numbers, just in and of themselves as songs rather than the kind of the lyrical content, I think are actually really good. And the kind of the production of it, I think it was actually quite enjoyable. It just lacked humour for me. Like, there were some funny lines, but actually the production and the music side of it, I think, was actually quite strong.
I think the other thing is, a bit like Pauline Calf as well, just kind of, this feels like comedy of a different time. Like, I don't think Coogan would come up with a character like this now. It's, you know, it is quite, I mean, deliberately so, it is quite sexist and stuff anyway, but it just doesn't, it just, the tone of it just feels a bit wrong in a kind of 2022 lens, I think. But I was going to say, like, for me, I thought what was interesting, there's a bit when Steve Brown, like, kind of freestyles a bit on the keyboard at the end of the song, and he says to him, "What the fuck was that? This guy's in my ass all day." And I thought, that's very similar to Alan saying, "Surprise me in rehearsal, Glenn. Don't surprise me in the live show."
Yeah.
I think the best bit of this Tony Farino section, though, is Ordinary Girl. I thought that was a great gag. Get a girl up that you're going to serenade, and then the serenading is, "You're an ordinary girl." I thought that was very funny. Also, she's about 8 foot tall.
The Tony Farino phenomenon was broadcast on the 1st of January 1997. So around the time of the first series of I'm Alan Partridge.
Oh.
It is a British comedy written by and starring Steve Coogan. It centres around a concert given by the Portuguese pop star Tony Farino, a music and dance spectacular which featured pop stars Mick Hucknall, Kim Wilde and Gary Wilmot in cameo roles.
Sorry, Mick Hucknall.
Mick Hucknall. And then also there was Introducing Tony Farino, Who and Why. And interestingly, and this
good question.
and this will come up later in the series. And then as part of the illusion that Farino was a real character, the BBC also showed a fake documentary interview about Farino's life called Introducing Tony Farino, Who and Why. And the interview, interestingly, considering what we spoke about last week, is conducted by Peter Bainham playing a character called Ross Woodward. A put-upon nervous interview host.
Oh!
So very
that's
similar.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, very very interesting, very similar to Roy Woolard, obviously. But no, in this Tony Farino show, he was Ross Woodward.
Also thought it was notable that you said that the Tony Farino phenomenon was written by and starred Steve Coogan. No mention of any co-writers there. I don't know how much of Coogan's run was solely Coogan on his own, but I did wonder if the rise of Partridge, where he's basically flanked by other co-writers, has sort of boosted him to the point that he tries to do Tony Farino alone, and that's perhaps why it feels like a thinner character.
Well, actually, if you look at Wikipedia, Tony Farino Phenomenon was written by Steve Coogan and Henry Normal. Coogan's run was written by Steve Coogan, Patrick Marber, David Tyler, Graeme Linehan, Arthur Matthews, someone called Jeffrey Perkins, and Henry Normal.
Yeah, so and Henry Normal obviously it was his partner in Baby Cow up to a point that it was Coogan and Normal's company for a while.
A couple of interesting things as well, just discussing all this. Like, I think there was also a spoof documentary about Steve Coogan a few years back, and also it's interesting the real documentary about Alan that was on the BBC in 2017, the documentary celebrating 25 years, was called Why, When, Where, How, and Whom. So there's kind of a bit, some similarities going on there, which is quite interesting.
Okay, is it time to visit our final character? Yes, so it's Paul Karff. For me, a little bit better than Tony Farino, but equally still not one of my favourites. It's still not up there for me. And actually, I'm not sure any of them were massively up there for me.
Paul Karff was basically Steve's calling card before Partridge, wasn't he? Like, he is the biggest other character at this point.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, that's it. Because if you look at the 1994 show, Paul Karff is the final character. So kind of like the headline, as it were, very much with Alan being the headline here.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it like that, that actually you'd build them kind of in that sense that you're most... or second most popular character you'd kind of leave to the end. I mean, again, I think there's a bit of like time and place here, isn't there, going on that in the 90s, I can see that this actually would be, you know, fresh and funny and I can see why it was popular. But the very fact that this character hasn't been revisited and, you know, he's moved on, we've moved on, comedy has moved on, I think kind of speaks to just the general appetite for a character such as this in this day.
You say he hasn't been revisited. He is in the 2009 show, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry.
But he's not been revisited on TV, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even Steve would probably recognise that people, broadly, there are going to be people that still like this and still find it funny. Of course there are. I just think that generally speaking, this character, the popularity would wane. But people are always going to... There'll always be a percentage of people that will always enjoy this sort of thing. And I think he knows that he can probably... revisit it in small doses, and that's kind of appropriate to do.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder as well if we were all perhaps a few years older, if we might engage with his character a bit more because we might have more familiarity. Like, I think even though, you know, at the time, kind of things like the day-to-day and Knowing Me, Knowing You, being vaguely aware of them, like, I think the Paul and Pauline Karff characters are characters that passed me by at the time. I don't think I had any awareness of them until... I saw them in the live shows personally. So that, you know, that's just one of those things. It kind of growing up watching TV in, you know, that era was a bit like, if you didn't see it or tape it, you missed it. So
did it occur to anyone else reviewing this and also, you know, more recent stand up of Alan's or Steve, sorry, that for the first time, it's not your parents' generation of comedy that you're having to kind of apologise for and say, oh, it was another time. This is the first occasion I think that I can think of that something that I remember coming out in the first place is now dated to the point that you wouldn't do it now. It was another time. It's the first time that another time is still my time on this yeah. time.
Although it's not like this is horrendous and like he'd be cancelled for it now, but it's just, I just don't think he's aged very well, I think is what we're saying,
well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, you probably wouldn't get cancelled for it because people would understand that it's in context, but there are certainly, you know, lines, words, slurs that come up across some of this stuff that you just wouldn't use now. And I mean, you can see it much more recently than this show. You know, even things like Little Britain. I think it was in the news this week.
True, very true.
Little Britain's been added back to iPlayer with all of the offensive sketches removed. So, I mean,
take
out the offensive sketches, take out the unfunny sketches. You basically got a BBC Three short at this point, haven't you?
I did like some of the lines that I did like in this though. When he talks about it being like Rill in the pouring rain with Dave Lee Travis. And also, like a retirement home for the terminally shite. You know, there's some nice use of words in that, I think. But, I mean, yeah, generally speaking, this is probably... to me, it's hard to choose between Tony Farina and Paul Carf, which is my least favourite. I still would place probably Pauline Carf slightly above this.
Yeah, I would.
And I think that's just because I think Coogan inhabits that character so well.
Something to say for next week's episode, but I'd be interested to hear the group's thoughts on where Tommy Saxondale sits in this pecking order as well, once he's introduced in later stand-up.
Yeah, we'll get to that next week. So before we get to Alan then, there's just another little Steve bit behind the scenes. And this is one of my favourite little bits. And, you know, this is what we were talking about a minute ago. He basically propositions one of the dancers, Becky. She's not interested, so he then tries pulling Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg rejects his advances, and he just says to him, I can have your fucking legs broken, and then I am chilling loud. Also, what I liked about this bit is he is drinking a bottle of hooch. Question for the group.
That is a great detail. Purple hooch that's basically depleted.
What flavour is purple hooch? I've got no idea.
Question
to the group. When did you last drink a hooch?
Oh, I know.
I know.
I think I know the answer probably for all of us.
I do as well. Who wants to...
Was it on board the Thekla in Bristol for Adam Stagg Do?
It was indeed, yes.
When you said, I think we all know, and I was thinking, I mean, the only correct answer is my Stagg Do, because I drew an absolute blank and couldn't remember. I don't remember that at all. I don't actually remember going to Thekla.
Oh, I remember that. It happened.
We've got video evidence. It was the last stop, I think, and by that point, it was absolute boozageddon.
it really was. A couple of other bits I liked in this BTS before we get to Alan. I just really find it funny him popping in. Hi, gang. Who fancied Chinese? Chinese. And just the fact that they all hate him and don't want to engage. And you also have... Steve Brown playing the keys, singing "He's the man we think he's a shit," which I also always enjoy. Right then, is it time for Alan Gordon Partridge?
I believe it is.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So yes, Alan's here, self-introduced, arriving in a champagne-coloured Vauxhall Amiga. There's some really nice bits right from the start. I like the detail that he has to request in the introduction that everybody looks to the back, because otherwise that bit won't work in both the APU and in real life. You know, the visuals of the show would make no sense if people weren't already turned around looking for him.
I love him kind of shaking hands with people, and then he gets to someone, he's like, not you.
Yeah. And in the opening banter, he's like, I can't have a protracted conversation.
Yeah. And then then the music stops.
Yeah, you're left with almost a similar situation, and where he has to kind of walk to the... he has to instruct Glenn Ponder to create a special kind of musical accompaniment just to kind of see him to the stage, essentially.
Yeah, and blames the audience member for making him late.
Yes.
Yeah. You see what's happened?
Yep. And then also, to answer your question, it was a gift from Timex. Are we meant to believe an audience member's actually asked him about his watch, or just that Alan wants to say that anyway?
I would take it that it's basically like him trying to do a bit of a sponsorship thing, a bit like, is it a Rover?
Yeah.
the show is called Alan's Forum.
Alan's Chat Forum. Don't forget the chat.
Alan's Chat Forum, but Forum for them, abbreviated to Forum.
Did you notice the set here? It's kind of like a mini Naomi Knowing You set. Very reminiscent of an afternoon with Alan Partridge.
The chair looks identical. I wouldn't be surprised if it was exactly the same chair.
Also, the forum gag. I don't know if this predates that, but the older listeners might remember a Trevor Simon section on Saturday morning TV called Art Forum, which was basically the same gag, art for them, art forum, where effectively they would just sort of talk pretentiously about art, and every segment would end with them going, let's roll on the floor. And then they all just rolled on the floor.
Oh,
a bit of anarchy. Was that,
is that around the same area as Swing Your Pants as well?
Exactly. Yeah. We don't do duvets. Yeah. That's a whole other show.
Yeah. We'll do a special podcast on Trevor and Simon.
I don't get any of those references at all.
You're missing out, pal. Did you also enjoy Alan coming on, getting all the ahas kind of out of the way, and then can we drop that now, please, become a bit of an albatross?
Yeah, I kind of want future Steve I wish that future Steve could meet the Steve of 98 to tell him what he was kind of in for. It's like, if you think it's bad now, pal, it's only going to get worse.
It's very similar to the Dan-nesty that we ran when we had Stephen Mangan on the show a while back as well.
Yeah.
Get all those catchphrases done, and then no one's tempted to shout them out later.
All right, we've had a bit of fun. Now it's time for the work section.
I like that he gives away the Kate Bush medley, which you would imagine a more professional Alan would want to keep as a secret and launch on people at the end. He's like, oh, it's fun, then it's the work section, then there's more fun. We haven't even done the Kate Bush medley yet.
yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
I think it's very much like, it's good, you're going to like it, it's good, here's why you're going to like it, and over-explain to prove why you will definitely like it.
When he's explaining the Alan's work sandwich, which is fun, white fun, I also enjoyed, for vegetarians, just substitute ham for, I don't know, chicken.
Yeah. Yep. Let's not forget he also calls the lead singer of U2 Bonio, which is a lovely bit of fun that he's boned up on Bono by the time we get to I'm Alan Partridge Series 2.
So the work section here is called LILM, Lessons in Life Management. So obviously this is what essentially morphed into Forward Solutions. So I think it's interesting how I think what we're going to get here is a through line from lessons in life management, forward solutions, strategy. I feel like that's the evolution of Alan Partridge, the speaker, as it were.
So this is effectively builds a business presentation, which he's given to Amstrad, lol, and then frozen food powerhouse Findus, and it snowballed from there. But crucially, no specifics on where it snowballed. My guess is it snowballed and stalled.
And melted.
And melted.
I mean, surely everyone around here on this podcast at some point has eaten a Finder's crispy pancake. Probably a student, I assume.
On the reg, yeah. It was absolutely
still.
Little known fact about them, you can toast them. No need to bother with an oven, even. Same goes for potato waffles.
Adam has toasted
them.
Oh,
you put them in like a kind of like a heatable plastic bag or something weird like that.
My understanding is that no bag is required, Tom.
My understanding.
Okay. Yeah. We'll learn.
I think
we're all learning something today.
I think you operate the same. I mean, don't try this at home without checking first, obviously. But I think you operate the same principle you would with a Pop-Tart. It's in.
I don't even know if you can still buy them. Can you? To the Facts Cave, and by that I mean Tesco.
One thing this the sort of theme of this this section made me think of for Strategem is obviously Strategem's written by the three of them, by Steve and the Gibbons. But I wondered if Steve would do more of the writing because, firstly, as you say, there's a through line of him sort of doing self-improvement stuff as part of his live show. But also, arguably, to my knowledge, the Gibbons have never written a live show before. The reputation and the reviews of Strategem will all be focused on Steve. So whilst I imagine they are still doing a lot of heavy lifting, I wondered if this might be an area where Steve's more involved than in the writing of, say, This Time.
But I'm pretty sure that next week when we get to the 2009 show, that was the first bit of Partridge that the Gibbons wrote with Steve.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they are credited. I noticed that.
I think that
credited.
Was their entrance to the APE. Yeah.
Well, then let's move swiftly on to some inappropriate gypsy jokes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that was next on my notes.
This very much seems like an area that Coogan presumably thought was something of a grey area in 1998 is very much not a grey area today. Saying things like, you couldn't host a thrice weekly chat show, I couldn't dump a burnt mattress in someone's back garden.
But if you think about it, the term gypsy is a term that is frequently used, because even in This Time, as you may recall, mm-hmm. he uses the term gypsy as part of the, there's sort of like a mini recruitment skit. So I think that Coogan has had frequent... It felt the need to kind of revisit that term. And I do think it's an interesting question as to kind of almost why he feels that need, because I think the sort of relationship with that term in the 90s versus where it is now is very different.
That's true. And also, obviously refers to, in Alpha Papa, damn gypsies tampered with the sights of the gun on Cromer Pier and things like that.
There's a real through line of gypsy baiting across the APU, isn't there?
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, you certainly couldn't argue that it's punching up from Steve Coogan's position, could you? So I do wonder, you know, if it's just something that he thinks, you know, I'm going to get away with it because it's funny, or whether, I don't know. I don't know what the justification would be, or if he would even feel the need to justify it.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know, but I do think this is a lazier use of it in this show versus where it's used, I think, much more sparingly and with a little bit more sensitivity, shall we say, in the latter Partridge, whereas this just feels a little bit in the nastier side of how that word could be used.
I suppose the argument, the justification as well, is that it's, you know, it's there to highlight the sort of idiocy of Alan Partridge rather than to kind of make any sort of serious point about the gypsy community. But I guess
that's the big thing you have to remember is, like, in theory, you know, this is Coogan portraying Alan. So, yeah, Alan is a bit of an idiot and gets things wrong and is a bit insensitive and doesn't always know what the right side of PC is. So that's the way to justify it.
So it's Alan, Coogan no. Is that what we're saying?
Well,
I think that's what Coogan would go with.
Yeah.
Speaking of Alan, yes, Coogan, though, and moving on to something that's arguably more punching up, when he describes Tony Blair as having managed to hoodwink a nation, I thought that's okay. That felt like a case of Alan, no, Coogan, yes. You know, I imagine Coogan is broadly in favour of Tony Blair, although perhaps he's more of a kind of traditional Labour supporter. But it does seem to backfire because a lot of people in the audience clap when he says that.
Yeah. He's like, ooh, a little bit of politics. I don't know what you guys think about about this as well, but I really thought when we get to this point in the show of Coogan being Partridge, to me, it feels like Coogan is, I mean, to use a kind of Partridge short term, is properly fizzing with energy. I just feel like there's a real physicality to his performance when we get to this character. He's properly bounding around the stage, like really leaning into it. So there's something about Coogan performing as Partridge more than anybody else where he feels to just kind of be in the kind of natural element where it's just like it's all flowing as kind of like a comedy persona. Did you guys kind of pick up on that at all? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. And also because it's a stage show, there is more physicality required. Mm. Like he needs to kind of dominate the stage. He can't just be sat on a chair or in a meeting like he would be in televised Partridge. So yeah, I mean, we'll come onto the bit in a minute where he tries to straddle the armchair, but there's some really nice slapstick moments that I think you need in a theatrical.
I mean, show. I think the armchair thing is like, actually, that's really skillful and adept physical comedy. Like, that's actually quite impressive and very smooth the way he does that.
Before we get to the sort of the chair straddling, should we just quickly touch on the egg of life? I mean, this is one of those sort of metaphors that doesn't really kind of make any sense, but basically the ambition or the plan is to try and get to the yolk. That's the ultimate end goal, right? It's how you can traverse your way into the yolk in the egg of life. And Alan
With hard work, we gain access to the white.
Yeah.
Which for me, I thought is that the first overtly noticeable hua in the Partridge universe? I don't know.
Quite possibly. I wonder as well if the egg metaphor is actually something that Partridge follows himself in that, you know, everyday people, the general public, are the pan. You know, people in his position are the white. And what he's always really wanted is the yolk, which is basically to be mentioned amongst the Edmunds, the Brandreths, the Holmes of this world.
So Edmunds is in the yolk.
I think Partridge's eyes, Edmunds in... Or I think in Partridge's eyes, what Edmunds is a bit of the white that's spat onto the yolk but doesn't deserve to be there.
What about Nick Knowles? Where's he in this?
He's a bit of grit.
He's a bit of shell that's got stuck in the white.
Yeah. Should we touch very briefly on the 3-point plan for how to get to that lovely, tasty Edmunds yolk?
I don't see how you could touch on it anything other than briefly. it's four words.
Nick, please talk us through it. Well, can you remember it?
Yeah, I can. It's a very clear 3-point plan, which involves think, then it's act, and then crucially, that's it. So I think you can argue it's a 2-point plan, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Also, it's the first of several pointed plans that Alan has for self-improvement through live shows, books, etc. And crucially, no two of them are ever the same. So it's not like he even manages. Yeah. He's not even stuck to his own plan for more than a couple of years without feeling the need to change it.
Anything to say about looks like a lady? In fact, it's a chap. Or do we just move on?
I think the lady boy, like... You can tell that joke gets a big laugh. So I think, and I remember the ladyboy sort of line being really funny, kind of hearing that at school, thinking it was really funny. And I think the audience are kind of really kind of enjoying that. Whereas listening to it now, I did think it was, again, like it was actually less funny hearing it now. But I remember being in the 90s and thinking, that's hilarious. But actually, I think that joke's lost its potency somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of juvenile. I think as well in this section where you've got him basically trying to be a rapper in inverted commas, saying, "What's up, G? Some homie's been dissing a bitch." Which again, like, I loved that back in the day because I think like Alan trying to be someone's street or a rapper or something. But yeah, I think many years later, it's just not that great.
I mean, that notion jumped the shark the day that Richard Madeley dressed as Ali G, didn't it? That was the day the music died for that joke.
I think the reason that the Ladyboy reference gets a big laugh is because that's your link to I'm Alan Partridge Series 1, yeah, which came out a year before. It's like, oh, he's, you know, kind of the equivalent of playing the hits, isn't it? Reference something from that and people go, ah, I remember things.
Tom, you're probably the biggest football fan out of the group.
Touchdown.
Did you have a note on Alan's synopsis on football here?
It's bang on.
So it's, hey you, pass the ball to him, and then score a goal.
Yeah,
that is how football works.
That's literally how it works. People pass balls to people and then they kick the ball in the goal hole.
There is quite a few jokes about Man City being crap, though, isn't there? Which I feel like in 98 was funny. And
in 98 they were really shit.
And now the football boot is on the other shoe and it's scored a big goal. And now they're at the top of the leaderboard.
winning all the games, scoring
Nick
all the goals.
Nick is the second biggest football fan in the podcast.
Yeah. Surprisingly, yeah, that he is probably, and that is breadth
that's
of his knowledge.
There you go. Come and celebrate with us at Main Road where we play.
Should we move on to the work section and descriptions of a goldfish, perhaps?
Yeah, this was among my favourite bits of the show because I feel like the audience really add to the atmosphere and sort of it builds to a nice climax. But also I do feel like, you know, Steve has prepared for this so well that the audience could have said anything and he would have made it funny. But
water.
The fact the audience suggestions are so wrong but also not completely irrelevant.
Can we talk about the man that gets up on stage in his massive sleeves?
Yes, they are ludicrous.
That's my first note.
Yeah.
The length of those sleeves.
And the colour. I think we should share an image of this on the socials.
Oh, I mean, talk about it was a different time.
Yep,
Jesus wept.
Someone is required on stage and Steve gets a man up and he is wearing, what does he describe it? A peach shirt, is it?
Yeah, but it basically looks like a kite that has been fashioned into a shirt.
It's huge. I mean, he's going to play a vital role, whatever it's going to be. He's got up on stage, he must be a vital part of the show.
So good.
So just to recap, the goldfish part is basically Alan's asking the audience to come up with attributes of a goldfish, presumably for another terrible metaphor like the egg one we've just endured. Has everyone got a note of all of the suggestions that the audience offer?
I don't know if I got them all, but I've got big sharp teeth.
Yeah.
Gravel, which always makes me laugh.
Hang on, it starts sensibly, doesn't it? Someone says gills. Fins or gills.
Oh, yeah. Gills is first.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've got the more nonsense ones.
then it's fins, and Alan poses, which came first, the fish or the yacht? Because that is a thing that makes sense.
Then it's gravel, I think. I think at this point he says, you know, I think you're shouting out to have a bit of fun, but this is the work section. I made that clear.
Yeah. Batter.
Batter
and water.
Yeah. I have a theory, and that theory is that when whoever shouts out big sharp teeth shouts out big sharp teeth, the camera cuts to an angle that is never used again. And it is basically the view that person who would have shouted that out has. It's a through line from where they're sat to where Steve is on stage. And that camera angle is never used again. Why? Because I think it's a stooge who shouts out that and gets... Because it's the first one and it gets everyone going. Once the first one goes and Alan slash Steve reacts to it, that gives the audience carte blanche to then start shouting out silly ideas. So I think the first person who shouts out big sharp teeth is a cameraman or a plant.
Also, big sharp teeth does have a bit of a hint of a polished line about it, doesn't it? Like,
yeah,
big sharp teeth.
You know
it's got comic time. It's got comic timing. It's got cadence to it of someone who has
I
feel like as well big that fresh gobs might get shouted out more than once. So perhaps it was kind of they just had that as a prompt point whenever they felt the audience weren't going to engage enough.
Mm.
I mean, it's just the same. Like, you know, in a TV studio, you have a floor manager that will start the applause. You have somebody to get everybody else to kind of go along with it.
And odds on, over 200 nights, you're going to have one or two that are shit or, people aren't engaged.
I mean, I did think it's absolute... The way that this plays out, particularly on what we've got in the DVD here, is absolute gold for Coogan, because the more the audience tried to be funny, the more he can emphasise that Alan would genuinely be annoyed by it, which just makes for a more comedic experience.
It's he doesn't have to... Because normally in a heckle, the onus is on the comedian to then, like, destroy the heckler.
Shut it down, don't rise to it, don't be annoyed by it.
Well, more so like the onus is on them to quip something back to the person who's heckled in order to get one over them, you know, to be really witty and funny in the moment. The comedy of Alan is that he isn't that witty and isn't that funny, so Steve doesn't have to have that kind of immediate reactionary, hilarious thing. He just has to be a bit annoyed and people will find it funny. He doesn't have to come up with a hilarious quip back. He can just get annoyed as Alan within the context of Alan and people will find it funny.
Yeah, and just reprimand the audience.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for example, saying, you're trying to be anarchic. Perhaps you're a member of Chumbly Wumbly.
If someone in the comedy store did that, it probably wouldn't get much of a laugh, but because it's Alan, it does. It makes sense.
Mm. That brief Chumbawamba rabbit hole I went down as a result of this, I realised for the first time it's Chumbawamba, not Chumbawamba with a U.
Is it?
Chumbawamba. And also, yeah. they were previously known as Skin Disease and Scab Aid.
What also did what? Obviously when this song when Tub Thumping came out, because obviously this would have been when this song would have been at its peak.
Well, this is around the time they emptied the bucket of water over John Prescott at the Brit Awards as well.
Yes,
so it was like and, a big newsworthy thing.
Yeah, I assumed that they were kind of like a bit of a fun, silly band, but actually, having gone back and looked at their sort of Wikipedia profile, they're actually sort of very sort of political and hence the egging or whatever they did with waterboarding of Prescott.
Waterboarding? It wasn't that extreme. They just dumped a champagne bucket of water over John Prescott's head at the Brits.
Yeah. So I just assumed that they were just a sort of novelty band, but no, they were quite sort of a left-leaning political anarchy kind of band.
Yeah. But they're in a bracket with the Levellers. I would say perhaps even more politically inclined than a band like the Levellers.
Oh, do you fancy a drink, Chumbawamba? Just the one. Little Levellers gag there for you. Is it time to kind of wrap this section up by basically saying the audience member that comes up on the stage is then basically sent away having done absolutely nothing?
Yeah, which is great. So good. Yeah, that is brilliant.
In a kind of scene that reminded me a little bit of what you see in This Time, where Alan is hopelessly scrolling through the pictures on the digi wall, we basically see lots of egg spooling pictures. I was a bit disappointed that they didn't make more of this joke, because actually you just get like lots of like similar pictures of egg.
Well, the good
getting
news
increasingly
is,
close on the yolk.
The gag is kind of repeated in less successful characters, and there are a lot more things to dissect in that bit.
Yeah. I mean, I guess obviously the joke that, you know, because he has the whole thing about the internal combustion engine, which he doesn't go into, as well as about 30 slices of an egg. So the fact that there's so much more in his presentation that we never get to see or hear. What was he actually going to talk about?
That's it.
I like that around this point, they've also established a bit of a trope of Alan's where he often doesn't define what he isn't without also feeling obliged to then repeat what he is. So
I'm Alan Partridge.
I'm not a healer. I'm Alan Partridge. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as well, that's I do quite like around the era of I'm Alan Partridge. That is a very strong character trademark, that the amount of times he literally says I'm Alan Partridge is a bit fun.
Did anyone clock, and I know the answer to this is basically going to be that, you know, it was written in 98 and it doesn't need to be part of the sort of wider Alan narrative over the years, but did anyone clock what Alan says happened in 92?
I did, yes.
So this is his wife, so this is Amstrad making it happen in 92.
Yeah, Amstrad made it happen. That's the first thing that happened in 92.
But I think what you're going for here, his wife left him. And then came back.
Yes. Shock horror. New news.
Because he'd won a small inflatable speedboat.
Also, he says inflatable speedboat. I'm hearing dinghy. So we've obviously never heard kind of this before and since. But yeah, it turns out that Carol briefly came back when Alan kind of dangled a dinghy in front of her and she couldn't say no.
Bangled a dinghy. Although, you know, the one thing we do know, there are a few discrepancies around Alan's wife in the early eras, because remember in the very early days she was a zombie. So you know, you can let some of these details go.
Okay, it's time.
Is it time for Wendy Banachek?
Yeah, it's compact chat with a special guest, and it's Wendy Banachek. And of course, I mean, this came as absolutely no surprise that he's got an interview with a lady,
Drystone Waller.
Yeah, he's got an interview with a Drystone Waller.
Remember, this is
he's struggled on guests for this.
Remember, this is the fun section as well.
I really like her aha as well. She absolutely fumbles it, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. But I think what gets me every time is the fact she just goes, "What?" in response. Like, he's livid and kind of baffled. But I love that, because obviously the implication is like, perhaps, Alan, your catchphrase isn't as iconic or widely known as you seem to think it is. Yeah.
Do you think Coogan felt obliged to include a chat section to sort of please the people who came to Alan through Knowing Me, Knowing You?
I don't think it's about appeasing. I think it's just at that point, that was the character, that's what it did. It was fairly obvious for it to kind of follow that sort of trope. So it wasn't as developed as it was now. So I just sort of think back then it probably made sense. And we're in for a lot of laughs, because this guest has bulimia and severe depression, which is also quite an odd thing to make light of, I would say.
And also, he pretty much opens with a story about how his urine infection turned his wee the colour of stout. So it's the fun section's off to a fun start.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, I forget which show it is in where he interviews the Milky Bar Kids, which is Simon Pegg, like a fictional version of Milky Bar Kid, and they're basically really depressed and stuff as well. So it's this kind of thing where he just doesn't really, he can't deal with the difficult subjects yeah. and kind of like the conversation that would raise, where, you know, obviously the joke being like a skilled interviewer would know how to adapt to that and probably actually go, oh, this is what I should make the interview about because it's actually a more interesting topic of conversation. When he just, he's like, stop talking about your personal problems because he just doesn't want to get into it.
He's more interested in imagining dry stone waller women as bearded ladies working through the night eating mice. the mouse eating thing, I thought, actually reminded me a bit of his hawker guest in Anglia Lives as well. So he's got a bit of a yeah. through line about eating mice for some reason.
So eating mice jokes about gypsies and eggs. All very prominent in the APU. Yeah.
Yes, and then also a racial slur around Chinese people, which is the main thing that comes to mind when I think about stuff that you wouldn't do in a show today.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's he just about gets away with it because of the context and how it's delivered and the fact that she's like, no, that's not right, we wouldn't say that. But yeah, I don't think you'd risk a joke like this now, would you?
No, and kind of... He makes that joke and it's undone by her saying, no, that's racist. But it's like, bad, you have made the joke. And yeah, I think it's a bit of
like, you've gone there, you have said the slurs. So yeah,
you've literally done it. Yeah, I think it's in the context of this, it's not great. But, you know, we've done enough scene setting and it's there. That's it, basically.
Alan has to try and veer her away from talking about her problems. She's actually quite adept at turning any question into bringing it back around to the issues that she's facing. So he says, you're talking about your problems again. She goes, sorry, it's nice to have the chance to actually chat about them. He's like, I know, just don't.
Yeah. How much do you want to dwell on the kind of Vomino's story towards the end of this section?
I think from now onwards, I think this really goes downhill for the rest of the show.
Not even with the medley?
I've never found the medley very good, to be honest. I've never found it funny or particularly good. But I just think from now on, the whole sick chat goes on way too long. And I think you can tell that it loses the audience as well. I don't think I don't think the audience particularly go with it that much.
The one bit I did love was when he's talking, he talks about the story, his friend used to pretend veg soup was sick and then Adam would pretend to eat it like a dog. But then when Alan goes, but it backfired, there's a really nice moment of silence there where the audience then kind of roar a bit because whatever is coming next, you know, is going to be funny. Like that's almost a punchline of its own.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the story, story's only halfway through. So that's
in a way, it would almost work with him just going and then it backfired and actually not going into the detail. I think it would almost work as well. I mean, personally, I love the Kate Bush medley. I mean, it's not, to be fair, it's not necessarily that funny, but I just really like it. I don't know. Again, it's a familiarity thing. I've just watched it so many times over the years.
I fast forward through it.
I would just like to quickly touch on Wendy's overdose as well, which is very quickly. I really thought this was going in a different direction. I thought it was very much the obvious joke, and the one they've avoided was that she, you know, slips out that she says she's taken an overdose. Alan continues to run the interview like normal, and then I thought about 30 seconds later he'll go, "Sorry, what?" like that, and then. Yeah. It will derail things, but no, he's so keen to get to the medley. She's taken 200 pills, and he just ignores it.
And the fact, again, if you go back, the timing and the delivery of this, the fact he literally just turns away from her, pulls out the mic, and starts singing is absolutely brilliant.
It's good.
I agree that I don't find the medley hilarious, and we'll come to this next week. But there are additional medleys, you know, in future shows that arguably don't work particularly well either. The one thing I do think that's good about this is the choice of Kate Bush, because if you look at the lyrics of Kate Bush and the kind of song titles, they're all packed with what are clearly very dense metaphors that Alan can then take as, you know, physical actions at face value.
Like, you know, rolling the ball.
Running up that hill, you know.
Let me into your window.
Exactly. He'll think...
It's a fun bit of physical comedy, right?
He thinks it's a song about rolling a ball. He thinks it's a song about jogging up a hill, and that's why it's so good. This is obviously recycled for Comic Relief as well, wasn't it? He basically redid
this was in Comic Relief 1999, which was the one also with Brian Ferry, which was also got a bit of a replay action in Anglian Lives.
Coming up to the end of this, I don't know if anyone else found this a bit jarring. I found it quite weird that the credits ran over the show itself. Like, with comedy these days, you know, everyone would be off stage before you see the credits roll. So the fact that it was given that kind of almost like a sitcom or a sketch show feel by having credits over the show while it's still happening felt quite weird.
I feel like that was just more commonly done back in the day for whatever reason. I feel like a lot of shows have that. Maybe it's literally like you can have a little bit less tape in a VHS cassette, which saves you a bit of money or something weird. I don't know. I did enjoy the kind of gag that closes this section as well, the sweatshops gag, where he's like, I've made some inquiries, and I just like the kind of subverting, and I've been assured the T-shirts are top quality. I thought that was a very kind of...
The children
that was
know what they're
solid
doing.
Solid punchline. Yeah. I thought that was good.
And the post-credits bit, obviously there's a final Steve Coogan section at the end where he's basically going on stage nude, which I thought was interesting because you can tell from the audience reaction that they've all been prepared for this, you know, and told to basically be completely deadpan. But there's one woman in the front row... Who did not get the memo and is absolutely shitting herself. And I feel like, you know, to try and keep that audience still and cooperative, they've had to go with a shot that is not perfect because one woman has broken, basically. Maybe they didn't have time to do it again, or, you know, they did it another time and then more people broke.
I'm pretty sure if you look at it again, I'm not 100% sure, but when I was watching this, it's like the way the lighting is done, I think it's made to look like it's a full amphitheater, but I think it's only the first sort of maybe 10, 12 rows. So I think, I don't know who those people are, whether they've got some people in early. I don't think it's a full auditorium of people. So obviously it was a lot easier, but still that one woman at the front pissing herself is great.
Also, these days you just digitally remove that person and put somebody else in, wouldn't you? Like, which wouldn't have been a thing back then.
I'd like to also talk about the artwork for this, for the sleeve, the DVD of this show.
Please tell me you love it. I think it's brilliant.
I do like it. I think one thing that's notable is obviously it's sort of Steve putting himself in a kind of Bond position.
Yeah.
You know, it's very Bond heavy. But also it's really of its time in terms of like the font and the kind of the playing on Bond. There's two other...
Very 90s font.
Very mid-90s. And specifically I'm thinking of the Terrorvision album, Regular Urban Survivors, which came out in 96, has got almost identical sort of attitude to font and artwork. And more close to Steve, I don't know if anyone remembers the comedy show Glam Metal Detectives, which was out in 1995, which also featured people like Phil Cornwell and Doom McKeegan, who have been part of Steve's projects. The artwork for that, again, is very similar in tone. That sort of like metallic font and that kind of Bond-esque... Like
that Terrorvision artwork is absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, a great album.
I'm just looking at it here. A couple of highlights. You've got Alan filling up his Rover with petrol in a forecourt, and you've got Pauline Calf punching a man. So that's quite fun. Also, there is a great quote on the DVD sleeve here on the front. This is the best night out I've had for 6 years. Noel Gallagher, Oasis.
Presumably, what happened 6 years ago? He just had a better one.
Yeah. Exactly that, yes. Has anyone got anything else on the epilogue? Because I thought we could have an actual epilogue with a bit of Coogan's drink and drugs heck, where when we're done with the show, I can just tell you how he leaves this era in his autobiography. But I don't know if you want to discuss whether he's working with lepers in the Gambia or as a PR consultant for Nestle first.
I mean, yeah, this is, I guess, a sort of final postscript that's black and white, where there's a suggestion that Steve is either working in the Gambia or he's spotted as a PR man for Nestle. I thought this was kind of unnecessary, to be honest, and actually didn't really work, wasn't particularly funny. And it felt like they sort of misjudged how to end it, because actually him being naked at the end of the show, it's like, cut it there. That's the ending, right? And I think this, and it's so somber that it kind of kills the mood of the show. So for me, that ending was, it just didn't work. And it was a shame that it ended like that.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think it was unnecessary. The bare-assed Coogan on stage would have been an absolutely fine ending. Speaking of bare-assed Coogan, would you like to know a little bit about how things went a little bit south towards the end of this tour run?
Tell us.
Okay, so this is towards the end of the chapter about this tour. He writes, "But all wasn't well. We had to cancel 5 dates in the middle of the run because I was partying too hard. The official line was that I had
was that the night out with Noel?"
Possibly. I was Noel and Liam, I think. Yeah. If you guys haven't seen Liam's stories about getting on it with Coogan, They are quite funny. Available on YouTube somewhere. I was going out every night, guessing on it, recovering and doing the next show. The audience didn't know what I was up to because I was looser on stage as a result of my hellraising. Skipping on a bit, I'd find myself in Soho House, a private members club, every night. In the end, Phil McIntyre, who was promoting my tour, had to send somebody to babysit me. Their job was to ensure I got into a car. I got into a car to Brighton at the end of the evening. I had to go home. I'd stay up far too late if I was booked into a hotel. And then just skipping right to the end of the chapter. By the time we recorded the second series of I'm Alan Partridge in 2002, I was sometimes falling asleep in the middle of a take because I'd been up all night. I couldn't stay away from cocaine. I couldn't be faithful. I tried to be good, but failed. Stop, start, stop, start. That is Coogan's drink and drugs heck.
Oh dear. Well, I guess if that brings us to the end of this live show, we'll be joining you next week, 10 years later, for Alan Partridge and other less successful characters, and finding out whether the drink and drugs are still taking a toll on Alan's performance, or whether the reviews are bad for a different reason.
I mean, just generally, what's our kind of overview on this? Do we generally like it? What are we saying? I mean, for me, I think the Partridge bit is one of my favourite half hours of Partridge there is, personally. But I think that is definitely clouded by the familiarity of nostalgia. Like, I've seen this many, many times, probably as much as, like, original I'm Alan Partridge shows. But, you know, it is funny watching it now. I could take or leave a lot of the other characters. I'd be happy with an hour of just Duncan Thicket and Alan Partridge. That'd be great for me.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a lot. I don't think I've watched it since the 90s, and I found watching it a bit of a struggle, to be honest, and I don't think I think I'd find it hard to recommend to someone that they should watch it in 2022, to be honest. So for me, it didn't quite hit the mark.
It's funny, I'm kind of somewhere in between Tom and Nick, to be honest. I would recommend this to someone, but I would only recommend that they watch the Partridge bit, because I think there is a lot of really great stuff in there. Duncan Thicket, I like. It's a nice little 5-minute sort of palate cleanser sort of thing.
Don't run away.
And I mean, it's probably a 6 out of 10. It's probably a 3 out of 5, to be honest. That Guardian review was probably bang on.
I feel like in places it's quite thinly written, and it almost feels like a show that's written knowing that they can do a certain amount of coasting on goodwill and fame. I didn't not enjoy it, but I do think... I do think it needed a bit. We could have done it with a fiercer script editor. But yeah, overall, I did enjoy it, but I feel like there's better to come. I don't know that live is the best forum for Alan necessarily. I think I enjoy the stuff that is on TV and radio a little bit more. So that's it, our thoughts on The Man Who Thinks He's It, Alan and Steve's 1998 opus. Next week, as I said, we'll be looking at Alan Partridge and Other Less Successful Characters, the follow-up tour that came a mere decade later. We'd love to hear your thoughts on either of those shows, or in fact, you know, your predictions for Stratagem coming soon. So get them over to us on Instagram at MonkeyTennisPod, Twitter at ThePartridgePod, Facebook.com/ThePartridgePod, email ThePartridgePod@gmail.com, leave a voice note on the Monkey Tennis hotline 07923 600 01. Or if you've just been enjoying what you've heard and want to chuck us a couple of quid to keep us covering Partridge into the future, it's ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, thanks and goodbye.
And I want something in the middle. Aha!
Yup, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Love pierced my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that? Like, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net.
Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.